A very big welcome wherever you're listening, wherever in the world, whatever time. Welcome to Misadventures in Music with me, Mick Ord.
Me, Ian Prowse.
Last time we did women who changed musical direction, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And got some good reaction to that. So this time we're doing men.
Yeah, we're doing the fellas.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And this is... We're going to start off with something that's really close to my heart, musically speaking, because it's kind of had an effect on my life and my music career. It's been really pertinent to the music that I've created myself. And this is The Waterboys. Famously, if you know anything about the Waterboys, had a massive change of direction, yeah. Which even to this day is still kind of the main talking point. If you ever read any interviews with Mike Scott, the leader of the Waterboys, it ain't long before you know they start talking about that time when they did their big change of direction. Even nowadays, this whole period of the Waterboys, which is kind of... what I'm talking about, mid to late 80s, is he still talks about it a lot. He talks about the amount of music that was made, and he reimagines the release of these albums and puts up different albums on Spotify and all of that. So it's something that was kind of a phenomenon, really, and it occupies his mind all of the time. And what it is I'm talking about is that in the mid 1980s, the Waterboys had a fabulous album called This Is the Sea, known as the Big Music, with many, you know, hundreds of overdubs. You know, the title track itself would have been, it's just two chords going round and round, but with an acoustic guitar overlaid about 20 times to create this huge, big, majestic sound. And that album famously has The Hole of the Moon on it. One of the greatest.
And that was a massive hit, wasn't it?
It wasn't actually a massive hit to begin with at the time. I think it only went in to the 20s. It became bigger later on with the rave movement. And then it became a proper big hit after that. But during the time of the album, it wasn't that big a hit. But everybody who heard it recognised it for the slice of genius that it was and is. You know. And so there they are. They've got The Hole of the Moon. They've written this fabulous album. They're steaming on along great guns, and they are there in the queue to be the next stadium band.
Yes.
Of you know, in the fashion of their fellow Celts, whether it be U2, you know, or Simple Minds, these big dreaming bands, you know, wide-eyed vision, and they with the attendant big music. So that is probably what the industry is expecting of them. It's all being lined up. And that one thing that that Mike, as the chief dreamer, would have been, you know, motoring along, this thing that you do when there's nobody listening and you formulate it in your mind, you get it going, and it all the musicians and the instrumentation and the songs, it's all come out of your imagination, and it's going great guns. And all you have to do for it to become world-straddlingly successful is follow what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Except he didn't do that. You know. Which, to me, is terminally fascinating and incredibly brave. Although we might say I didn't even think about it that way, but there it is, the world is laid out at your feet, and you actually go, you know what, I'm not going there, I'm going over there. I don't fancy it down there. I've got another idea. And what he did was that they'd gotten, when they made This Is the Sea, there was a song on that called The Pan Within, and they had a violin on that song. An Irish guy called Steve Wickham had played on the song. And then he became part of the ensemble. When they'd finished the touring for This Is the Sea, Mike went over to visit Steve in Dublin, stay for a couple of weeks and stayed in his house. And he basically never came back. You know, he was so taken with what he'd seen and heard in Dublin musically, there was a shift in his songwriting. And I think pretty early on, after this, he wrote the song Fisherman's Blues, which was to distill this brand new sound, you know, which, to put it in for the non-musicians out there, to put it in its basic forms, whereby before I was talking about there would be overdub after overdub, 20 acoustic guitars on This Is The Sea and big instruments, with Fisherman's Blues, they would be kind of live takes, one take, you know, one take of a fiddle run through or a vocal, or they would all play together, you know, in the sense of the way that musicians used to do.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So they are very, very different ways of creating music. And there's a big thing here in that there's a difference between good songs and great records. Great records is a separate thing. People always go, oh, I could tell a good song if it was just an acoustic guitar version. That's as may be, but great records are, again, a different thing. So how you go about in the process of that is really interesting. So he's created Fisherman's Blues, and I think they recorded that very early on and got the take that ended up years later on the album. But that kind of opened the door. This is, you know, this is something special. Everybody's reacting to this song, Fisherman's Blues, which just starts off with a big open G chord. In comes a strike on the mandolin, and then the most amazing fiddle playing by Steve Wickham. And Wickham was to become central in this brand new journey that was going on, you know. And Anto Thistlethwaite, who was the sax player in the big music, now just reverted onto mandolin, which I love, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's gone from that to this, and the three of them are the you know, the kernel of just sitting around creating this new song. And one of the things is that which somebody should write a thesis on, is the fiddle in rock and roll is an interesting thing, because it's kind of, it's bigoted against by the British music press, you know, for one reason or another. They're always kind of keen, and certainly were in my day when we first got Pelé going, to kind of diss the fiddle. There's some sort of prejudice in there, which would be good to write about. So, but obviously, Mike Scott and the boys, they don't care about this. So we're going to hear a track now. And this is when they're at the very beginning. I think they're still in Dublin before they go elsewhere, before they really, really change. And this is like a collision between rock and roll music and that fiddle of fire. And it's just wonderful. So we'll have that now. This is called We Will Not Be Lovers. as a little production aside here, just listening to that, it's the only the second song I've ever heard where the lead vocal is accompanied by a whisper of somebody. If you listen intently, somebody is whispering. Well, Mike would be whispering the lyrics at the same time as the lead vocal, and you don't so much hear it as feel it. And the only other track that I've ever heard that do is Riders on the Storm. And I know Mike is a great student of rock and roll classics, so I imagine that's where he might have got that idea from. And again, it's wonderful because you don't hear it, you just sense it, you know, in your subconscious. So
that's such a subtle way of communicating. Yeah, I mean, that's
beautiful, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's a really clever way of adding to something that almost under the radar, almost subconsciously.
Yeah. So here we are now. Mike is sidestepping his own ascension, you know, on the precipice of fame with another type of music, and they're starting to make this. And I know they went away to America to make some other recordings with a famous producer, and they came back, and that's when it really, really changed, because they went out to the west of Ireland. And the reason why this is different is, see, Dublin is, there's aspects of Dublin which is still, you know, Dublin was like one of the big cities of the British Empire, and even to this day there's a, Dublin's, it's like a big European city now, but there's still an essence of Britishness to it.
Oh, yeah.
The Royal College of Surgeons never changed its name despite the revolution of, you know, 1916. A lot of dubs will tell you there's still an essence of that clinging.
Well, that's why they call them the Jacks, isn't it?
Yeah. The clinging to the city. You know, they will be called West Brits and various other pejoratives by Republicans. So the irony of all of that is the north part of Ireland was traditionally the most Gaelic part of the island, you know, back in the 15th, 16th, 17th century. So now they've decided to relocate out in Galway, and not even Galway City. They've gone further again out to a tiny little place called Spiddle, and there's an old big house there called Spiddle House, where they set up all their equipment and started to really, really dig down into Irish music and Scots music and country music. And it's flowing out of them. Apparently they recorded over 100 songs. And what I love about this, and this is the real wonderful part of this story of taking a left turn musically, is you've got to understand that once you go out there, you know, into the west of Ireland, you really are entering a different realm. You know, you're off into, you know, the Celtic dream time. The people are different there. They speak a different language. They're a very different tribe. Winston Churchill used to famously say that the problem with the Irish is they refuse to be English. You know, that's showing up. Yeah. Complete Westminster prejudice and a misunderstanding. And they really were different. You know, the people out there are as different to the English as you know, the Italians or the Russians or any. Yeah. They're completely. And if you hear the Irish language, it has nothing at all to do with English. You can hear links in English with German and French, but there's nothing. It's a completely separate linguistic, you know, branch. And the way that the music is made. The music in when people sing in Irish, the music like kind of melts into the melody melts into the music. It's really beautiful, and that has spilled over into the way that the people out there make music. Ireland's the only country in the world with a musical instrument as its national symbol. Yeah. So when you're out there, this is a totally different setup. And what I love as well was apparently. Their record company, Ensign, so it's a major label, they couldn't get in touch with them. And obviously money must be being spent hand over fist here, you know, for this record. And they go, what's going on? They'd have to phone up the local pub, I think, in Galway, you know, the next place along, and they'd pick them up once every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Ensign said, have you got anything for us to hear? And they go, if they phone back, tell them not long now or whatever, you know, whatever the forms of communication were. So they were isolated. And that is, you know, they're into their own world. You know, going to play in the local sessions in the pubs, and they're picking up musicians, the real deal here now, musicians.
Yeah.
I think it was a fiddle player called Charlie Lennon, and a guy called Thomas who narrates the very last song, "The Stolen Child." Beautiful bits of music, and they've made so much music, and it's 2 years now since they famously appeared on the Tube playing their new song, "Fisherman's Blues," complete change of direction. I remember seeing it and going, "Oh my God, that's unbelievable!" And it sparked up something in me, which brought my own songwriting into focus. And then when Pelle made our first album, "Fireworks," my idea of it was a slightly poppier version of the Fisherman's Blues album, so it was completely inspired by it. You know, so. Here we are now. They're really into the local community and the local people, and the local people are probably going, who's these crazy guys in Spittle House, you know? And I imagine there was plenty of Guinness and so forth going on, and they recorded over 100 songs, and at this point, that you know, they've got to stop doing that. They've got to put this record out, you know, because it's 2 years after they first appeared on the Tube playing it. People were excited by that. Going, where is it? Where's this album?
Yeah.
And I know nowadays Mike says, "Oh, we didn't get the selection right of the tracks on Fisherman's Blues," and he says this song should have been on it, or that song should have been on it. I disagree with that. I think his instincts were right first time round. I think the collection that he put on the record, having it now heard all of the other ones, I think he got it absolutely right. And it's a most wonderful record. And the best thing about it is it went on to be their most famous album. And Fisherman's Blues, the song, is his most famous song and most covered and everything. Which is lovely, you know, it's lovely. When you have a song like when Christy Moore does this train stop on Merseyside, and I can go onto YouTube and watch 60 or 70 different versions of it by other people.
Oh, wow.
That's a wonderful feeling for a songwriter. So I have a small, only tiny inkling of how Mike must feel having written Fisherman's Blues, and it's such a standard. And it changed everything, Fisherman's Blues, because before that, people saw it as a folk rock.
Yeah.
You know, if a fiddle came in or a traditional instrument, it was folk rock, and folk rock, what sort of a term is that?
Yeah.
Whereas Mike changed that. It was now Celtic soul, and it was much kind of cooler.
And
a lot of bands were turned on by it, the Wonder Stuff, the Levellers, Pelle, and it stands the test of time. It still sounds fantastic now. What we'll do is we'll have a listen to them way out in Spittle playing their very, very best Celtic Dreamtime music, in my opinion. And this is probably the song that when I heard this, I went, "Oh, I've got to have a fiddle in me band." And this is called "When Will We Be Married."
When will we be married, Molly? And will we wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? And will we wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? You have your eye on Jimmy, long Jimmy Lee. You have your eye on Jimmy, yeah, the fine man he. You have your eye on Jimmy, but better let him be. 'Cause when you go, Molly, oh, you'll be gone with me. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? You have your eye on Johnny, then Johnny Fee. You have your eye on Johnny and the fine man he. You have your eye on Johnny, but you better let him be. 'Cause when you go, Molly, oh, you'll be gone with me. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? I made a black bow for your pretty head. When will we be married, Molly? When will we be wed? black bowl for your bunny head. When will you marry Molly and will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed? When will we be marry Molly and will we be wed? When will we be bedded in the same bed?
Okay, so that sounds like a traditional song, but it's actually not. Mike Scott wrote that song, you know, at the time, but it's obviously infused with the area.
It sounds completely authentic. I was just about to ask you. It's that amazing. Must be a traditional one, that.
No, it's not. No, you know. So this area of Galway is Gaeltacht, which means that it's Irish speaking. And there's only a few of them on the whole island of Ireland. The language basically kind of died off with the famine. And as an aside, at the very beginning of Wuthering Heights, when Heathcliff is found on the streets of Liverpool as a foundling, as a dark-eyed, you know, wild, little, angry, and it's in the book, Emily Brontë says he's speaking gobbledygook. He's not. He's speaking Gaelge. It's just that they don't understand it because it's English. He would have come over from Ireland, you know. Yes. You know, again, that distinction between the English and the Irish not understanding each other, you know, because they're very, very, very separate cultures, you know. Mike, the way that he's distilled that into a song like that is just perfect. So, yeah, that is the biggest left-field change, you know,
that
for me.
A mega
that
change.
Song is a million miles away from, you know, Don't Bang the Drum or one of their kind of big rock songs.
So one final question about that.
Yeah.
What's he doing now? Do they do both kind of types, or does he just stick to the latter, if you want to call it that, the latter iteration of his music?
No, I think they pick and choose from all over his career, which is
the
right thing to do. Fair enough, you know. It's all you know. You've created all of this stuff, so yeah, do whatever the hell you like. Fair enough.
That is one hell of a. Not a U-turn, is it? An L-turn? A left turn. Well, we're going to talk now about Johnny Cash.
Okay.
And I didn't really know much about him, to be honest, until his latter work, because it was music that people of my mum and dad's generation, who are, you know, long past now, but that they liked it. And I kind of considered it to be quite, you know, show bands or...
Yeah.
Club music, you know, a bit snotty about it, actually. You know.
Same here.
All right. Well, when you read about his life and what he did, it is absolutely amazing. So if you are a Johnny Cash fan, you'll know all this. But if you're not, I'm hoping that we can surprise you a little bit. He was christened J.R. Cash because his mum and dad had an argument over... there's a theme here. His mum and dad had an argument over what to call him. His mum wanted to call him Ray and his dad wanted to call him John. So he was actually christened JR. Then he changed his name later to Johnny.
Okay.
Anyway, his ancestors were English and Scottish, and he could trace his Scottish ancestors back to the 11th century Fife. Wait for this. He's a distant cousin of the arch Tory Brexiteer Bill Cash. He really is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really.
Well,
so,
Mike Scott is from Fife, I think. So there's a connection.
Oh, my word.
Well.
Yeah, okay. Brought up in by poor cotton pickers in, I think it was Arkansas he was born, yeah, around there. Early influences, gospel music and radio. He went to Memphis and sat on the steps, metaphorically speaking, of Sun Records, trying to get a deal. And he had a load of gospel songs, and Sam Phillips wasn't interested in gospel at all. And that was a big love of Johnny Cash, which he had throughout his life. So he wrote a song about trains, and he wrote quite a lot about the trains in his life. And the first song was a hit. It was a rockabilly hit in 1955. We'll hear a little snippet of it. It's called Hey Porter.
Hey Porter, hey Porter, would you tell me the time? How much longer will it be till we cross that Mason-Dixon line? At daylight, would you tell that engineer to slow it down? Or better still, just stop the train, 'cause I want to look around. Hey, porter, hey, porter, what time did you say? How much longer would it be till I can see the light of day? When
we hit. So that was Johnny Cash in 1955. In 1956, he then got to know Elvis, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, who were all under Sam Phillips' son. They used to jam together, and half the songs they did were gospel, and the four of them were jammer and all that kind of stuff. And wow, those tapes emerged later as the Million Dollar Quartet.
Wow.
Which was, Sam Phillips must have been rubbing his hands if he was still alive at the time. But he didn't want Cash to record gospel. But because Cash always wanted to, he only gave him 3% royalties rather than the standard 5%, which all the others got, you know. He was the first Sun artist to release an album, and all the stuff that we know about him later, performing in prisons and stuff, the first time he did that was like 1959.
Right.
He was doing this stuff early, you know. He'd been brought up during the Depression. He'd seen what life was like from the hard end. From the 50s, he shared a flat with Waylon Jennings in 1959, and very early on got addicted to amphetamines, barbiturates, drinks. Shared in a flat with Waylon Jennings, who's a notorious hellraiser himself.
Okay.
So he had a very, very kind of lively, shall we say, and completely different to the way Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis's career went. And then started to have a lot of hits. They used to team up with the Carter family, who were a massive, massive influence in country music in America. And Ring of Fire was one of his major hits. And I've been looking at trying to, did he write Ring of Fire? And there's two versions, well, at least two versions to it. One is, yes, he wrote it and gave the royalties to June Carter, who eventually became his second wife. She's from the Carter family. Or I've heard that June Carter co-wrote it with someone else as well. But whatever, it was a massive hit. And I know most people in this area, particularly Liverpool fans, will know this song because it became their anthem a couple of years ago. So we'll hear a little bit of Ring of Fire. Yeah.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, down.
That riff is burnt onto my mind because I sang at the European Cup final in 2005 when Liverpool famously came back from being 3-0 down. We did a gig at the Ataturk Stadium in the big fan zone outside, and I was first on. And every time I finished a song, 30,000 drunken scousers would go, and then I'd kind of battle on and do another one, and you know, and then it's last chord. So I have mixed feelings about that song.
Is it true that Jamie Carragher's dad was the one that he used to go to all the Liverpool away games? And I'd heard the story that it was his dad, because he played it so much, all the fans gradually.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I'd heard that one. Yeah. And if it's not true, it's a crazy story.
It must have come from somewhere, mustn't it? So, yeah.
Blame his dad for it anyway. But one of the things that interested me about Johnny Cash when I was looking into it, because we kind of know, in the first few bars, you know, it's a Johnny Cash song from those days anyway. He wasn't afraid to kind of upset anyone ever. In fact, on the contrary, you know, whether it was drugs and drinking and all this kind of thing. And in 1964, he issued an album, Bitter Tears, or tried to issue an album, Bitter Tears, about the plight of the Native Americans. And this is a spoken word album and songs.
Oh, wow.
And CBS did not think that was a good idea.
No.
They did not want to release it. It was eventually re-released a lot long after that. But that was one of his major
progressive thing to do somebody from a redneck background.
And he was not at all ashamed of anything like that. His rendition of Ring of Fire, just to go back to that, it was a crossover hit. So it was a massive hit in the pop charts and also the country charts in America. But Bitter Tears, it did initially hit the charts in 64, but a lot of resistance from a lot of fans and from radio stations, and they rejected his controversial take on social issues. And then in 2011, a long time after, a book was written about it, led to the re-recording of the songs, there was a film about it, and there's a film released by PBS in 2016, and it's called Sings the Ballads of the True West. But there was a documentary film about Cash's efforts with that album, right. And I really want to see that. Maybe if I find the link, we can put it in the notes.
Yeah.
Throughout his kind of career, it was dogged with kind of drug addiction and destructive behaviour. And even though he won Grammy Awards and all the rest of it, he proposed to June Carter on the stage in Canada in 1968. Things were kind of not looking good for him, really, in the 70s and beyond that. And his kind of sound had started to deteriorate a little bit. But he continued to do all the prison songs, because Live at San Quentin was a massive hit. Have you seen that?
These
are classics, aren't they?
Yeah.
He continued with his Native American work and all that kind of stuff. He had his own show in the 70s as well, own TV show. He had Bob Dylan on it, Ray Charles, Joni Mitchell, you know. So he wasn't afraid to kind of go beyond the country world, which I guess country music, like a lot of genres, can be a bit insular looking, particularly that. And he managed to spread his wings a little bit. So mid-70s, his popularity and the hits began to decline. He started making commercials, TV commercials and all that kind of thing, published autobiographies. Invited to appear at the White House in 1970. Nixon wanted him to play. Do you know that, the Merle Haggard song, Okie from Muskogee?
No.
Which is an anti-hippie song, really. Right. Anti-hippie, anti-drug users and Vietnam War protesters.
Right.
And Cash refused to sing that.
Okay.
And Nixon kind of famously said afterwards, he said, I learned one thing today, and that's not to tell Johnny Cash what to sing. He became quite a close friend of Jimmy Carter,
right?
Who was the president after Nixon.
Yeah.
And I think she was distantly related to June Carter.
Right.
But one of the big turning points in his career was when he met the producer Rick Rubin. And what happened is he was no longer being sought after by major labels. And Rubin saw him at a concert and thought, I could do something with this guy, you know.
What year was this?
Well, this would have been 1994.
Oh, so this is much later.
Much later. Yeah. Yeah. His career had been flopping in the 80s, late 70s. 1994, he recorded American recordings in his living room. All he had was his Martin Dreadnought guitar. That's all he had. Things were looking a bit crap for him, to be honest. You know, he was trying to relive past glories, and it wasn't really happening. He was appearing in TV.
Yeah,
like he appeared in Columbo as a bit part actor. You know, he was kind of doing everything. He was diagnosed with some neurodegenerative disease.
Yeah.
But the last stage of his career was when I, for one, started to reassess him and not to think, this guy knows what he's on about.
Same here.
And American 4, The Man Comes Around, is 2002.
Yeah.
So we'd done a couple of these albums. Cover songs by Depeche Mode, loads of them. And the big one that, if you don't know Johnny Cash, the one that I suspect you got hit by was the Nine Inch Nails.
Hurt. Yeah. Well, there's the other one that really got me from that era of him, Hung My Head, which is an amazing song, and I was so surprised to find out that Sting wrote it, and I've seen Springsteen do a version of it since. But yeah, and he did Personal Jesus.
Yeah, by Depeche Mode.
Depeche Mode. So they really thought outside of the box with the types of songs that they thought he could interpret.
Yeah.
And his interpretations are almost always spot on. You know,
well, Trent Reznor said he owns it now. Yeah. He owns that song.
Oh, Hurt.
Yeah,
for sure, yeah. I would never listen to the Nine Inch Nails version.
No.
Anyway, it's something about the sound of it which doesn't appeal to me, but as soon as I heard Johnny Cash's version, and then, of course, there's the video as well.
Well, that's unmissable, isn't it?
Yeah, cannot go without being mentioned.
No.
Talk about art.
Yeah.
You know, whilst you've got one foot in the coffin.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But and fair play, such utter bravery.
And I guess we're singing from the same hymn sheet in a sense. The early stuff doesn't do much for me, but I can recognise how important it was.
Yeah.
And that. But when you hear Hairs, the first time I heard it, hairs on the back of your neck talk about that, isn't
it? Well, when I was young, if I ever heard that,
yeah,
like the first song that you played there,
yeah,
when I heard that kind of click and that rhythm of the Telecaster guitar playing those old, yeah, 50s and 60s riff and the clipped reverb and everything, it felt like a very old-fashioned world to which I had no references or anything.
Yes.
And I just didn't like it at all. But now when I hear it, I've got a lot of time for it.
Yes.
I feel as though I've kind of cracked the code of how you listen to that sort of music, and my life experiences are vaster, so I feel as though I have the armory to be able to emotionally understand it a bit better now.
Yes.
So I do actually like early Johnny Cash. Almost as much as I like those interpretations he did just before he died, you know.
Well, for me, the later interpretations then kind of gave me permission to go on the early stuff. And
yeah,
the Ballad of Ida Hayes,
yeah,
which is about a Native American guy who was one of the people to plant the flag at Iwo Jima in the Second World War.
Wow, okay.
Beautiful song. Yeah. And his love of the underdog comes from his upbringing in the Depression and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
and playing in the prisons of that. But you've got to search it out, because there's a lot of stuff that, you know, it's...
You might have him down as just a straightforward, like, Republican sort of American sort of thing. It's interesting that you found the door in there and then went back, because that happens with a lot of artists.
Of course, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of artists that you've heard of your whole life, but you just don't get it. And then all of a sudden, you hear... This is how I got into Springsteen. I heard his Tunnel of Love album, 1987, and that just opened up everything else for me, and I was in the door then,
yes,
and I could go backwards,
yes,
and I could follow him into the future, and I understood everything, but I didn't understand it until I had the key music, you know, to get in. And I think that's what's happened with Johnny Cash.
Absolutely. And because we live in such a disposable culture, if the 3 minutes that you happen to hear on the radio don't turn you on, you're going to reject that artist, aren't you?
Move on to the next one that does, so, you know.
Well, here's Hairs anyway.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I will let you down, I will make you hurt. I wear this crown of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else. I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend. Everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all. My empire of dirt. I will let you down. I will make you hurt. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself. I would find a way.
Wow.
Yeah. Beat that.
Top that. Yeah, I mean, the ultimate artistic achievement must be to release your best stuff,
yeah,
and then pass away.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I want to do.
Absolutely. And he did that. And in fact, on that last album,
yeah,
I think he only wrote one of the songs on it. And this is when he's died. He died a couple of months after the recording, yeah, of this. And it was a Train song called Like the 309.
Wow.
And we won't play it. We, yeah, don't need to. But, yeah, I hope this inspires some people to go to the American recordings.
Yeah, they are.
Because,
amazing.
Well, if you don't know them, they're worth going to.
Yeah.
And if you don't know his career, it's a good way of getting in.
Yeah.
Like we said before.
It is. It's wonderful. So, which brings us on to one of the major left field changes of when I was a young man. And that would be something that is still being talked about to this day. And the poor artist in question, almost every interview I ever see with him, he still has to answer the question, even though he's answered it about 5,000 times. And that is, Paul, why did you split the Jam up? And so I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about Paul Weller's Left Turn, which to us fans, you know, in 1982, I think it was, came out the blue. You know, we weren't party to what was going on inside the world of the Jam with their, you know, the people who worked with them, the band and everything. So all of a sudden there's a statement, the Jam are going to split up. We were all completely taken aback.
Because they were at the peak.
The Jam were at the very, very peak. They were... I saw the Jam 5 or 6 times, and the thing about going to watch the Jam was, the first time I saw them was at the Liverpool Empire, then the Mountford Hall, and then I think they did 3 shows at Deeside Leisure Centre, which kind of covered Liverpool and kind of North Wales, the North West and the Wirral. Now, I think there was 10,000 people in Deeside Leisure Centre shows, nobody over 20. It was phenomenal. There was just a youth movement. It was just young people everywhere, you know. And the Deeside Leisure Centre shows famously, especially the first one, just descended into riots. Ellesmere Port fighting Birkenhead, Birkenhead fighting North Wales, Liverpool fighting Birkenhead, Birkenhead fighting North Wales.
And were you there for that?
I was there for all of them, and it was terrifying inside it. And they were kept, while the band were playing, there were just massive gaps kept opening. And I'd see some nutter from the port run across into fighting against people from Connors Quay and all this. Just, you know, it whatever Paul was trying to achieve with youth unity and everything, yeah, else with his songs ain't working that night, you know what I mean? And it was a bloodbath, basically. And very scary, you know, because I couldn't fight my way out.
So how old would you be then?
I would have been 15 or 16 then. So it was my band, you know. I'm only sat here talking to you now because of Paul Weller and the Jam. That was what inspired me in the first place. And they were massive. It was kind of like, I got into them during the end of the modern world, all mod cons. So, and they weren't massive then. They kind of stepped over in with that, with the song that we're going to play in a sec. And it's hard now to explain what they meant, because they became this huge youth movement, and Paul Weller became like our spokesman, you know, of our generation. He was our leader. You know, people would, I remember being in the audience at the Royal Court, and people were shouting at him, "Leader, our leader." You know what I mean?
Wow.
It was
And was he embracing that?
Not really, not openly. I mean, I'm sure he quite liked it when it first started, because it's kind of what a compliment and what an honour. But then I'm sure it became a burden very quickly, you know, because what's he going to do, you know?
Yeah.
You know, lead the revolution. This was the world that the Jam were in, and they were, you know, then the number one hit singles just came. They got really, really big. And at the same time, there was another huge band, The Clash, you know, and it was kind of like people liked the both, but there would, you know, people would also be in one camp or another.
Yes.
Now, what doesn't get said much about fans of the Jam and Paul Weller at that era is just how influenced by The Clash Paul was. And I think he was, he said about the first Jam album in the city, he's embarrassed by some of the lyric writing because he was attempting to mimic The Clash, who were writing about issues. And Joe was 4 or 5 years older than Paul, I think. So I think he kind of looked up to him, right, you know. But Joe had a bit more, and Joe had been all around the world as a kid, so he had, his palette was broader.
Yeah.
And Paul was kind of trying to emulate it, didn't quite pull it off. The music sounds fabulous on the first Jam album in the city, but he's embarrassed by some of the lyrics.
Okay.
At this point, because he's trying to copy The Clash, you know. And some of the songs, there's a song called Standards off the Modern World album, the second album, and it's just that clipped Clash riff that, you know, that you heard on so many Clash songs. But now they've kind of grown bigger than The Clash, and The Clash had, Joe had famously written the lines in what many contend to be the greatest Clash song of all time, White Man in Hammersmith Palais. It got Burton suits. They think it's funny, turning rebellion into money, which is a straight criticism of The Clash, because Weller had said, oh, we might vote Tory.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there was antipathy going on between the two camps as well, even though it was clear that, you know, Paul was inspired by them. And all of these things, you know, were going on, and the Clash were very different, because the Jam, now this is my own particular theory, this is what I'm going with, and I've, believe you me, I've thought about this for a long time.
Misspent you.
This is my world, you know, this is where I came into music. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for these wonderful remote educators that I had in Paul and Joe and Elvis Costello and, you know, Hugh Cornwell and all the rest of it. And The Clash, though, were very different to The Jam. This would be, a brilliant thesis for somebody to write at academic level. The Jam were provincial, and they kind of talked about the small aspects of life, working class life, which is why we love them so much. You know, Saturday's Kids, what they were doing. And it was kind of, you know, it was like a satellite town of London where he's from, Woking. So it was kind of they were looking inwards, at their lives, and he was detailing it in the way that Ray Davies did to the Kinks, you know, little details of lives, which was what just made us fall in love with them, you know.
Yeah.
Down in the tube station at midnight, it's claustrophobic, it's violence, it's what we go through every day in our lives. If you live in those sort of areas of London, yes, or wherever, we could, in my working class council house in Ellesmere Port, I completely got it, you know. And then Paul would start singing about girls, and I got that as well, you know. So as the Jam went on, but the Clash didn't do that. The Clash were international.
Yeah.
The Clash were outward looking.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
They were they had an album called Sandinista. What the hell's that? You know, what does Sandinista mean?
Yeah.
And basically they were giving support, tacit support, to a Nicaraguan revolutionary movement, which we all had to go and find out, because what are they talking about? You know, what's this about?
That wasn't the Jam's.
The Jam were a million miles away from doing that. So it was, you know, openly revolutionary and openly political. You might say it was just a stance and it was just, you know, for decoration or whatever it was. And Joe wore all the T-shirts, famously wore a H-Block T-shirt in solidarity with the Republican prisoners in there. And, you know, a Red Brigade T-shirt and all of this stuff. And he got slagged off for them. He did apologise at times for some of his... But he was looking outside.
Yeah,
he wasn't looking at England just. He was looking at the entire system.
Yeah.
The entire capitalist system, if you will.
Yeah.
And as I said in one of the other podcasts, Joe brought to my attention that, you know, the, all the wars that Britain were involved in, they were arming the other side to make money. You know, that's an implicit criticism of capitalism and the industrial military complex, of which is a very real thing going on to this day. Jam would never have done that, you know. So they're two very, very different atmospheres. And I always say that they were exemplified by the fact that if you listen to Clash songs, Joe is forever ad-libbing with throwaway but brilliant lines. Elevator, going up. And he says things all the way through the songs, which the Jam never did. They were, you know, they were concise, the songs were
saying. Yeah, very tightly kind
yeah,
of.
Very, yeah, controlled. But Joe was forever riffing. He's riffing left, right and centre. And I think that came with just his more international... He'd seen a lot of the world. And he'd had a lot of tragedy in his younger life as well. His brother had committed suicide. And Joe, of course, went to a public school, you know. He had the awful thing. I've never understand it, and I never will, why posh people give their children away at the age of 8, 9, 10. It sounds to me like the cruelest thing you could possibly do. Yeah. I've got a 9-year-old. If I give her away to a boarding school now, I just feel like I was hurting her.
It's a different culture, is it?
It's a totally different culture. Yeah. Which one I will never understand, and I will always rally against. So all of these things, you know, go towards, as the Jam are getting bigger and bigger, and Paul is feeling the constrictions of all of this. He's the guy they're all looking at. They go, you write the hits. You're keeping this entire show on the road, you know. And there's only three of them. There's this power trio. They try in the later stage of the Jam. They've got a horn section in, maybe a Hammond organ player. But it's still all on his shoulders. And him and the drummer don't like each other anyway. He feels they're all ungrateful. And then out of the blue to us, but it's obviously been stewing in his mind, he finishes the Jam. And at that point, kind of one of the first things he does when he's freed himself of the obligations of the gigs they've got and the records they've got to put out, he turns away from Britain and he looks to Europe, you know. And before you know it, there's pictures of him with the Eiffel Tower. They're in European cafes. He's playing up the Italian side of being a modernist, you know, the international European aspect of being a modernist, the shoes and the suits and the scooters and all of this sort of stuff, being a lot more overtly political. He doesn't care. He'll add his name to things, which he would later maybe regret, but, you know, he's writing songs directly about the miners' strike and all of this sort of stuff. I think that he always had an eye on what the Clash were doing, you know, because the Clash were like embraced hip hop. Magnificent Seven is a hip hop record. That Mick, specifically at the Clash, he'd written Lost in the Supermarket. I think Paul had emulated him in The Crowd, which is a better song actually by Paul, in my opinion. But he was always had an eye on what they were doing, you know, his greatest rivals, so to speak. So that was the first thing that came about when he formed the Style Council. He made it a freer, you know, association of musicians. He got a great drummer in, Steve White, who's a friend of mine, and I've had the privilege to play with him on several occasions, and my God, can he drum. I've never come across anybody who hits them like as hard as Steve and as true as Steve does. He immediately had a better rhythmic bass. Now, Style Council was struggling in some areas because people would never forgive him for giving up the Jam.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, he's got, you know, on his records, he's got rap, he's got gospel, he's got jazz, you know what I mean? And it's a million miles from this song that we're going to play now, which was the first crossover hit for the Jam, really, where they went from the lower, you know, from going in at number 20 to going into the top five, and this is Eton Rifles. So that's the archetypal Jam sound. Oh. Loud bass riff, slashing guitars.
Love it, love it. Oh.
So, Paul, whilst that's an amazing sound and changed my life without a shadow of a doubt, how far are you going to go, you know, with those three instruments? There's a bit of organ in there, obviously, as well. So, obviously, at the end of a long day, despite everything else, Paul just felt like, you know, he wanted to do other things musically, and he felt that, you know, wasn't capable. When, you know, these are the last records where the bass is so loud, you know, he gets when he goes into the Style Council, it's not like that anymore.
No.
You know, that's not what is great about those records. And it's, the Style Council did some magnificent music. They really did. People are obviously very myopic when it comes to them, and they shouldn't be. They should go and listen to them again, because it's amongst some of Paul's best work.
Did they sell? I can't remember.
Yeah. Oh, they did, yeah.
I mean, I bought a few of them, but I can't remember whether they were...
Well, they sold a lot. You know, they were huge, like Long Hot Summer. and they were big hits, and You're the Best Thing, and he seemed to be much happier, you know. He was much looser, and they were constantly taking the piss out of themselves, you know, in videos and this, that, and the other. Yeah. And it wasn't so that Spokesman of a Generation thing, which was the weight heavy on him.
He always looks intense in the jam, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and which I loved, you know. That's what got me going, you know. Yeah. It fired me up. But then when he got to all this, he just seems to start just enjoying making music and not feel all of that, you know, coming down on him. I've got to act in this certain way. So there's a lot of humour going on. And in the end, I think he says himself, that wasn't going to sustain him, and it kind of just drifted away and, you know, drifted down to nothing. But when they first began, it was really, really interesting. And he was doing types of music. This is the Left Turn that we're talking about. He's doing different types of music. He just never got away with in the jam. There's a lot of instrumentals for a kickoff. Mick Talbot's amazing Hammond organ player was just leading on these great instrumentals.
Yeah.
And they're really good. If you listen to them now, you know, in the modern era, they really stand up, you know, and they're like authentic kind of 60s inspired pieces as well. And I remember the very first Style Council song I heard after Speak Like a Child, I think, was the first thing that they put out. But the first one I heard off the first record, we're going to play it now, and I was knocked sideways by it because it's just him and a guitar, and it's a lovely piece. So we'll have that now.
The lords and ladies pass a ruling. The sons and girls go hand in hand. From good stock and the best breeding, paid for by the silver class, who have been told or lie in state to bow down forth and face their fate. Oh, it's easy, so, so easy. Oh, righteousness did build that arrow to shoot it straight into their lives. Who would expect the mighty sparrow, oh, could rid our world of all their kind, rising up and taking back the property of every man? It's so easy, so, so easy. Thing. From family trees the jukes to swing. Just one blow to scratch the itch. The laws made for and by the rich. It would be easy, so, so easy.
That's lovely. I haven't heard that for a long time. So his singing's changed. He's not singing in such a pronounced southern, what we'd call Cockney accent. You know what I mean? I remember I met him a few times when I was in Pelé. I got the joy of hanging around with him a little bit, and he was absolutely lovely. But I was taken aback by just how strong his accent was. And he was, but it was really, you know. And now hearing that singing,
it's more mature, isn't it?
And he must have. It must have been a conscious thing, and it's better. You know, the singing's better.
Yeah.
And for the non-musical out there, he's playing minor seventh chords. I would say that was the. They were new to him, but I think Private Hell starts off with a minor seventh chord, a classic jam track. So, you can hear the change there. And And one thing I love about him all down the years, he just does what the hell he wants, and he's never reformed the Jam, and he's absolutely right not to. I'm so glad that he stuck by his guns. He famously said, I think, or somebody said when he split them up, they will always be remain our Beatles, because they finished on a high like the Beatles,
yes,
and they will never become our Rolling Stones, because, you know, it's just kind of petered out and just doing, you know, like the cabaret circuit of former glories. So yeah, I love him for that, and I love him for,
well, I'm going to listen to some forward. Of the I'm going to listen to some of the old Style Council albums.
Yeah, okay.
Because Jam you hear a lot,
yeah, you do
anyway,
yeah,
but
yeah,
you don't hear much of them, do you? And the, as you say, they had some great stuff,
yeah.
And then he moved on after that as well. You could have done another feature on Life After the Style Council.
Yeah, and I love him for that as well, by constantly creating. It's a good signpost in how to be a true artist.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, the next artist we're going to look at is...
We're accompanied by the rain, by the way. Can you hear the rain?
adds to the ambience.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
I
like it.
Well, very appropriate from the next guy we're going to talk about. Scott Walker.
Okay.
Oh, wow. And I've only recently got into him in the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Because he issued some very weird albums a couple of years ago.
And is that right down your street, a bit of weirdness?
It is, because when you kind of think of people that do left turns, you kind of think, okay, he's doing this, and I read some reviews of it. And in similar way to Johnny Cash, this is how I got into his earlier stuff. Scott, the Walker brothers, they were brothers.
Oh,
and none
oh
of
were they?
And none of them were called Walker. There's something about this. We'll move on to this in sometime. But Scott Engel, Noel Scott Engel, born in Ohio. Brought up for most of the time after about 6 or 7 after his parents split up, went to California. Was a bit of a song and dance teenager in musicals and stuff like that. Good session guitarist, bass guitarist, played a lot of bass around the sessions and all that. Then formed a band with a guy called John Maus, M-A-U-S, who had adopted the surname Walker to get a music performing license in California. And then they met up with a guy called Gary Leeds, who'd been a drummer with PJ Prorey in this country, and they formed the Walker Brothers. And Scott, actually, famous for his baritone voice, but he actually wasn't the original lead singer, it was the other guy. And they had a song called Love Her, that was their first... They came to the UK after the Beatles and the Stones explosion over there, and they came to the UK, and they had I think it was a top 20 hit with Love Her, and Scott took over the vocals for that because they thought it would fit better. And he was one, if you see photos of him in the 60s, he's the archetypal blonde, good-looking teen idol. He really, really was. Beautiful voice, and he had the kind of voice that people's parents would like. It wasn't just the teenagers. I mean, my mum and dad used to love his voice. Which is why I remember seeing him on telly, and they were all good looking.
It was like a crooning sort of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, you'll know the main hits.
Yeah.
And to give you an idea, because the contrast between how this guy started and how he ended up, I don't think there's another example like this. At least not one that I've found. Maybe there is. But let's listen to the first song of theirs. And you'll know from the original... You'll know from the first few seconds what it is, so I won't bother introducing it.
Loneliness is a cloak you wear.
So, massive hit for the Walker Brothers in the mid-60s, and they followed that with a load more hits, and they had 3 top 10 albums, and it was good. But by the time of the late 60s, bands like, you know, Cream and other heavy bands were coming in, and it became a little bit, sounded a bit dated, the orchestration and all that. You know, it wasn't really 60s rock culture. Yeah. And Scott broke the band up, I think it was about 67, 68. And then he had a couple of solo albums, and they did really well. The first one was called Scott.
Right.
Scott 1, Scott 2, Scott 3 all did well. And he included cover versions, but he also included his own compositions and some great songs. Montague Terrace in Blue, Big Louise, you know. And then Scott 4 he released, and it was all his own compositions, and it bombed. Didn't do anything, not at all. And after you've been at the top of your game as a solo on a band artist, it must have been a real kick in the balls for him, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't do any more for a while. Messed around with what we would call middle of the road or country albums in the 70s. He thought, well, I'll reform the Walker Brothers again. So in 75, he reformed them again. And I remember the song they did. They did No Regrets, which is a beautiful song.
Great song.
It's not his song. It's Tom Rush's song. But he did it. And then they had an album out, Night Flight. Didn't do that well commercially. Well, in fact, they had 3 albums, but Night Flight didn't do really well. But interestingly, on Night Flight, there's a song that gave you a hint as to the area that he wanted to move in. It's a song called The Electrician, which is a disturbing piece, which pointed the way forward. Bowie loved him. Yeah. Big hero of Bowie.
Right.
And Scott's last performance on stage was what was described in the newspapers as a stumbling performance in Cabaret in 1978. Right. He was not into Cabaret.
You know,
he was an intelligent guy, written some really interesting songs, couldn't find his direction.
He's having to pay the rent, though, isn't he? So
he was having to pay the rent, and he was living on very little at the time. He's actually talked about that, you know. But Julian Cope, in 1981, Julian, formerly of this parish for a while anyway, he released a compilation. I don't know if you've ever heard it. Fire Escape in the Sky, The Godlike Genius of Scott Walker. Have you heard that, Ian?
I've heard the title, but I don't think I've ever heard this.
No.
I know a lot of that era's Liverpool male singers, mostly called Ian, really love Scott Walker, and you can hear it in their vocal deliveries.
Yes, no, that's a good...
Very
that's
much.
That's a really good point, that. So Scott kind of... 1984 then issues The Climate of Hunter. Some of the tracks don't have titles, just track 1, track 2.
Oh, right. That's revolutionary, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this is 84, I think it was. And it got critical acclaim. Yeah. Brackets, didn't sell many. Close brackets.
I know the feeling.
And then, like... in between, he'd kind of given up music and then had, you know, made this album. In between, he'd been a painter and decorator.
Oh, really?
And he'd done a fine art course as well at university.
Wow.
But he still had a cult following, not only from the people who loved the 60s stuff, but also people like Julian Cope and maybe that. Tilt was the next album he wrote.
Right.
And Tilt, The Guardian, wrote about it. Imagine Andy Williams reinventing himself as Stockhausen.
Oh, Jesus.
And Tilt, harsh and industrial, I think you'd call it.
Okay.
And it's not an easy listen, but none of his stuff from then on is an easy listen. But I really do think it's genius, a lot of the stuff he does. And with each new release into the 21st century, Walker pushed boundaries, he says, reading this from this note I've written here. They were sound blocks, really. You wouldn't really call them songs, although he called them songs.
Yeah.
And they were like movies. They were snatches from a movie. And one of the things he did on one of the albums was he hadn't written the songs. He hadn't written many of the songs. And he got these top musicians, including Mark Knopfler and others, top musicians, to just record stuff. So he'd say to you, OK, you do the organ.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do? Well, just play it. So he had them as guitar, you know, drums, organ, whatever it was, and then he'd compose the songs and then he'd fit them into it.
Right.
So really interesting way of doing
it. So there's no, like, classic song structure, you know, verse,
no,
chorus, midway,
no, not to, outro. Definitely not Tin Pan Alley.
Okay.
The opposite. He did one called The Drift, Bish Bosh, Big Blocks of Sound, Raw and Stark. A lovely quote from Scott from 2008. I am an outsider for sure. That suits me fine. Solitude is like a drug for me. I crave it.
Oh.
And he turned... I mean, we're going to... The track I'm going to play is called The Escape, which the first time I heard it with me... with my earpods on, I had a nightmare. I mean, I had a very strong Catholic upbringing.
Right.
Right. And that's given me all kinds of nightmares at times. Nothing horrible happened to me.
No.
But I remember listening to this when I was lying falling asleep, and my word, it was like a nightmare.
Right.
But very powerful. And once a year to listen to it, I suppose. Right. But this is where some people will think this is complete pretentious bollocks. And I understand that.
You have been warned, listeners.
Yeah.
Michael has warned you about what we're going to give you now.
No slowies on Scott Walker's album, as it were. But before we do, right, there's a story to the song.
Okay,
it's quite difficult to hear the lyrics, but it's about a Jewish rabbi in the Middle East watching a car bomb incident happening.
Right.
And so it's a very dark subject, and subjects like this, really dark, are what Scott, his latter albums, is all about. And there were hints of it before from his previous stuff, but we've just heard The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore, and The Sun Ain't Certainly Shining in this, The Escape.
The car in front follows the Lord.
Thank you.
look into its eyes. It will look into your eyes.
What happened?
Thanks for that, Mick.
Jesus. What was your initial reaction when you heard "What's Up, Doc" at the end?
Yeah. That, in terms of what we've been talking about across the men and the women of the biggest left turn, that's the biggest.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so far away from the sun ain't going to shine anymore.
I know. And I still get a cold shiver when I hear that. It's demonic.
Yeah.
And and he's saying...
What's he saying?
What's up, Doc? And he slowed down the voice.
Right.
And I think it's Daffy Duck rather than Donald Duck.
Right.
There's a subtle difference there, which I'm sure many people realise. But, and that's what it's about, a car bomb in the middle. And my word...
God.
I went on one of the forums this morning about Donald Duck. I went on one of the forums this morning about Scott Walker, not Donald Duck. And a guy has a quote from Nietzsche.
Right.
Which why not? We haven't had a Nietzsche quote
yet.
He hasn't been around for a while, has he? And there's a quote from him, and he says, the song The Escape reminds me of a quote from Nietzsche. He who fights with monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. And when you gaze into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you.
Brilliant.
That's a brilliant quote.
Reminds me of the scene in The Wind That Shakes the Barley, Ken Loach's masterpiece.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Whereby Cillian Murphy's character, who's fighting a just war against English oppression, and at one point he has to, because of the war, he has to shoot an old school friend who's basically been informing upon them all and ruining their chances and putting all of their lives in danger. So he's a traitor, but he's got to shoot him. And he says, I sure hope this war that we're fighting for is worth it. You know?
Right, yeah. Dark.
Because nobody gets away with it war.
No,
nobody gets away with it. For all of your honourable intentions, the abyss is always staring back into you if you're staring at it, which is absolutely wonderful and terrifying.
Well, I think that track is pretty terrifying.
It is, yeah.
And there's a couple, there's a few of his albums. I mean,
what was it like when you were listening to that track for the first time and then that happened? Why the hell did you go and listen to it again?
Well, because it's so, I genuinely think it's real art. I think
it's
good. Yeah. His voice is still really, really good and distinctive.
It is,
And the more you learn about the way he puts it together, the better. And what we'll do is on the episode notes, we'll put a link to a documentary that was made a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And it's a real eye-opener. I mean, one of the tracks on one of the albums, he's got someone hitting a giant piece of, I think it's pork.
Yeah.
And he's trying to get this percussive sound, like a dull thud, and he eventually gets it. And you're just thinking, it was worth it.
Well, it's funny because when the song first starts, it just sounds like an odd version of Scott Walker.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of discordant.
Yes.
And, but you can still locate Scott Walker very definitely in the song.
Yeah.
And then it goes there.
Yeah. So there's Tilt, there's The Drift, there's Bish Bosh. And also, and in 2014, he made an album with people who were described as the shroud-wearing Seattle drone metalers, Sun. S-U-N-N, and the album was called Soused.
Right, okay.
Or Soused. And Scott describes that as a pretty perfect match. Okay. Scott died a couple of years ago, but I'm just become a real fan. And unlike Johnny Cash, it's kind of, I like his early stuff. I like all that pop stuff from the Phil Spector.
That reminded me of when I go into Fact here in Liverpool, and they have exhibitions on in the dark room, and you watch. It's very arty, you know, and you watch a series of things flash up in front of your eyes, and it's always kind of accompanied by odd and discordant music like that. So it's an artistic statement, all right.
It is, and I mean, I don't know anyone that's made that leap, but when you go through his music, even some of the solo hits he had in the 70s. Like he discovered Jack Brel by talking to a woman in the Playboy Club in the late 60s, I guess. All the, and he does a great song called Jackie, which is a Jack Brel song, which is a cracker.
Yeah.
But that's Scott Walker anyway, and I hope at least a few people listening discover it, because there's a lot there, and it's difficult, and you won't be playing it every day of the week, that's for sure.
If they're not hiding under their beds right now. Jesus.
Well, we'll put a few links in the episode notes, and for those that are interested, an adventure awaits you.
We will be interviewing Mephistopheles, Beelzebub, and Old Nick himself next week. We've got them up from the hot place.
That's right.
Jeez.
I think we need to lie down now, mate.
I definitely do. So that's a good place to end, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
That is a true misadventure in music.
It really was. Thank you, Mick, for that. Thanks for having that one for us. And we'll see you soon on our next misadventure in music.